8.
Good evening, folks, and welcome back, everybody. I'm T.S., and this is the simulcast up and running now for the Ides of March. As Caesar said, beware the Ides of March, 1995. Jerry Lewis is on this program tonight, live from New York City, after completing his performance tonight in the smash hit Damn Yankees on Broadway in NYC. Also tonight, motion picture maker and artist Clive Barker on the program to talk about the newest Candyman feature, which is coming out, I believe, on St. Patrick's Day, the 17th, which would be the day after tomorrow. When I worked in radio, early on in my career, I did a disc jockey show on Saturday nights, and when you came on, you would always thank the preceding DJ for the past 3 hours of programming or 4 hours of programming. And I want to thank David Letterman for the past 1 hour of programming here on CBS tonight. What I found especially fascinating was that tonight Dave interviewed our friend Jon Stewart. And Jon Stewart, his program is the reason that we play at 3 o'clock in the morning in Washington, D.C. And, you know, Dave was great. He says, what time is your show on? And Jon Stewart said, that'd be at 12:30 at night. And Dave said, what's your competition there? I mean, whose team are we on here? I'm sure it'll be explained in the meeting tomorrow. Anyway, coming in today, we started talking about the office pool. Which is coming up here for the Academy Awards. And I've decided to absent myself from that because the last time I did this in radio, I was the winner and the staff didn't speak to me for 3 weeks. So I'm going to chip in the $5 and not worry about winning this year. I don't know why that's up there because I had no notes on the office pool. tomorrow night here, we may be on the air earlier in the Western time zones as well as the Eastern time zone. The NCAA cranks up tomorrow night here on CBS. And so following the last game, they'll run the local news on local stations, and then we'll go on because the Letterman Show is dark, I believe, tomorrow and Friday night. So we're all kind of wondering today what time we'll get to go on the air in the East. And I can tell you from experience what happened at NBC, because they had the NCAA back in the 1970s. We would think, geez, you know, we're going to go on at 11:45 or 12 o'clock, which for us was a big deal because we didn't start till 1 o'clock in the morning. And most nights we didn't get down to 1:20 or 1:30 because of, you know, they always have double overtime or extra time or something. And so you might want to check the game tomorrow night because we'll be on 30 minutes following the game after the late local news. You see, that's what I was talking about. There's going to be an office pool on what time we went on tonight, and I thought it was about the Academy Awards. Yeah, I had a very nice letter today from Phyllis Diller, who watches the show regularly, and you all know her. She's very funny, and she's become a good friend to this program and to me. And she sent along a little cartoon that I'd like to share with you, and it needs no explanation. You folks at home, watch the monitors. They got it. Jerry Lewis is right around the corner in New York City, and then a bit later on, Mr. Clive Barker, whose Candyman picture is coming out, I believe, on St. Patrick's Day, which would be this coming Friday night. And regarding the office pool, strike all that. Take it out of the record. Thank you. We'll be right back after these messages. Settle back and watch the pictures as we get this show on the road. We have all known Jerry Lewis most of our lives. He is among the most popular entertainers in the world, and his newest triumph is playing the devil, Mr. Applegate, in Damn Yankees, and he is now the toast of Broadway. And Jerry joins us from the CBS studios in New York after tonight's performance. Jerry, thanks for staying up late, and welcome to CBS, my friend.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you again.
Now, you did a show tonight. You finished at 10:40, and, I mean, aren't you exhausted after every performance?
No, I did two shows today. Wow. We had a matinee and then the night show.
All the things that you've done over the years in show business, I mean, you truly have been in every kind of venue and every kind of situation. On opening night, right before you made your first entrance, any jitters at all?
Yeah, plenty. The jitters are there. The butterflies were there. The nerves were there. But not as bad as I thought it would be. I think that it was buried by the rush that I had. The rush was incredible. To dream about something for 63 years and then there it is. Mm-hmm. The nerves take a back seat to that wonderful, that natural high that you have. It's incredible.
You know, before this project began, and when they announced that you were going to be coming in as Mr. Applegate, as the devil in Damn Yankees, there was a great deal of speculation as to whether or not Damn Yankees could survive, whether it had the legs to keep going. You know, they took the show down for, what, 6 weeks during the tough weeks?
2 months.
Yeah, 2 months down. And there were some people on Broadway, Jerry, who were not betting on you. They were betting against you. So you must take some satisfaction in the almost universally great reviews you and this show have gotten.
Well, I take tremendous, I take deep pride in the fact that the people in the audience are communicating such love and such affection and such warmth that company and I are just fascinated by every new audience that we play to. It's incredible. I was angry Monday because we were dark. There was no show to do. And these young kids in the company are saying, when do you rest? My birthday today, by the way. 69. And I'm working with all these young cockers, you know, that have to take Monday off. And at the press conference in January, we were at Sardi's, and one of the newspaper people said to me, how are you going to deal with 8 ruling shows a week? I said, Dean and I played the New York Paramount and did 8 shows a day, 56 a week. In 2 weeks, we did 112 shows, went to the Chicago Theater and did 9 a day for 63 shows. So in 21 days, we did 175 shows. I said, you're talking to me about grueling 8 shows?
Yeah.
He says, let me remind you, you were 20 years old at the time. I said, that's okay. At 20 years old, I did 175 shows in 21 days. At 69, I can handle 8 a week.
What is different about doing this show as opposed to doing all the concerts that you've done, all the appearances with Dean, all the movies? I mean, you are certainly comfortable in front of audiences. What is different about appearing in a Broadway show?
Well, first of all, you're part of a wonderful story, a beautiful plot, and you're working with an ensemble. You're part of a team. It's the beauty of Tinkers to Everest to Chance. It's that simple. I have a company of people that are impeccable professional performers, and every range of age in that group. And we have such a marvelous rooting interest for one another to score, mm-hmm. and have the show score, that there's a passion along with the energy that's impossible to define.
In this show, Damn Yankees the plot line here is that the Washington Ball Club hasn't won the pennant in God knows how many years, and
right.
It's all the fault of the Damn Yankees, and a deal is made with the devil, played by you, to let the Senators win one, for heaven's sake. Has that plot line been altered in the slightest way to accommodate the fact that baseball is now having a strike and that baseball is in the news?
No, not at all. It has not been compromised. The material is absolutely, we are dedicated to the material. It's been a marvelous show. The strike has had no bearing on the show. We're the only professional game in the country today. There's one line in the show that gets a tremendous laugh when one of the performers, Dick Latessa, says to Terry, who's the owner of the club, he says, one of these days, one of these bonus babies is going to hold us up for money. And Terry says, no, this is baseball, not business. That gets a wonderful laugh. Well, the devil is listening to this, and the devil steps downstage and says, I'm inspired. I just got a wonderful idea for 1994. And they absolutely fall apart. So that's the only reference to what's been going on.
Let me ask you about Jerry's kids, who we see every year Labor Day on the telethon.
Yeah.
You've been on the air for 27 years. You've raised over $650 million. And yet we still have muscular dystrophy. Do you ever get disappointed or discouraged that a cure hasn't been found, that more progress hasn't been made, that more treatments aren't available?
No, we are probably, we have made the greatest inroads in the history of medical science. In the last 5 years, the DNA and the genetic engineering have given us answers to problems that we thought were never, ever going to be on the horizon. We've made tremendous inroads. We're funding some of the greatest technology in the world. And in my lifetime, I will see the cure. I'm being guaranteed that by the researchers and the scientists in this country today through DNA.
People who watch me would be critical if I didn't ask you about those who say that you sometimes bring these kids out and make them objects of pity, that you use these children in an inappropriate way. And I know that this is a very small area. But you know, Jerry, there are always the negative people, and I'd just like you to speak to this point. I mean, I know what your answer is, and I support your answer. But for those who criticize you for the telethon, what is your answer for them?
My answer is simple, Tom. I'm dealing in life and death. I'm watching children that would not have had a chance had it not been for what we have supplied researchers with. I will not be deterred. No one's going to stop me. Splinter groups that think what I do is wrong cannot stop my forward motion. It's that simple.
We're with Jerry Lewis, who joins us from CBS in New York, who's one of the stars of Damn Yankees on Broadway. You can join us on the toll-free at 1-800-95-CBS-TV. Back after a short break and these messages.
Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets.
Number 666 got a big laugh here in the studio in Southern California, Jerry. Very, very funny.
That's great.
Here's Bill on the toll-free in Delta, Ohio. Hello.
Hello.
Good evening, Bill.
Good evening to you. I wanted to ask Jerry, now that he's kind of fulfilled a lifetime dream of performing on Broadway, what his next big endeavor is, if he has one, or what he would like to do that he hasn't already done in his lifetime.
I'd love to be a Viking.
And why is that, Jerry?
I'm kidding. This is about it. It doesn't get any better than this. But Tom, I have to tell you something I didn't tell you. I have been such a fan from the very first time I ever saw you on NBC. And I come into New York and I sit with Jason Weinberg, my press representative, and I'm looking at this slew of stuff that I'm going to do selling Damn Yankees.
Right.
And I said, I don't see Tom Snyder here. So they said, well, Tom's in L.A. I said, I don't want to know about it. I'm doing Tom Snyder. I need to do that. I've been a tremendous fan.
Thank you. I watched them
all through the CNBC series, and I need to do it. Now, tonight, they told me you're going to sit around for 2.5 hours waiting to do it, and I had to keep my mouth shut. But I just wanted you to know, I love the show.
In other words, what do you mean? I don't need to do this guy that bad. You don't remember this, but I told the crew here, when I was a kid out here working at Channel 5, it was owned by Paramount Pictures at the time, and you were making something on the Paramount lot, and they sent me down there to interview Jerry Lewis. And I got there, and you would have no way of remembering this. You were so kind to me and so kind to the crew. I mean, every time that I have ever asked anybody associated with you to do anything at all, you've been there for me. And I'd like people to know that. You're one of the good guys in this business. And most people who know you, all people who know you, share that opinion. More people should know you as we do who work in this business. Anyway, Bill, thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. Jerry's really kind of made me happy throughout the years. I've always admired his Night Professor movie. I've enjoyed that quite immensely.
Well, thank you, Bill.
I think you've made a lot of people happy, and you'll probably continue doing that the rest of your lifetime. And
thank
I appreciate
you.
It.
That's the plan.
Bill, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Okay. You know what's obvious as I listen to people talk to you and read about you? You're family in this country. I mean, you've entertained this country for I don't know how many generations, but you and, by the way, the fellow you used to work with are family to us.
Yeah.
How is the fellow you used to work with?
He's doing fine. He's happy because he's a recluse, and I check on him constantly to see how he's doing, and he's doing better. He's doing fine. He's happy with his lifestyle, and we must respect what he likes for him. And I do. He's doing fine.
He's not a very public man, is he?
No. No. He's always been a recluse. I guess that he and I got closer to Dean than anybody in his life, including his family. And he was always very, very, very much a loner. And our relationship developed some stuff within him that he never expected, and it was 10 wonderful years. But I'm concerned about his well-being, naturally. I love him very much, and he's going to be fine.
Looking back on it, you know, you're 69 years old today.
Yes.
You know, we're all getting wiser and older. Was 10 years too short a time to work with Dean Martin?
No, it was perfect. The timing was perfect. I think that we broke out of that at the time that we would have liked Joe Louis to have quit before he got knocked through the ropes. We knew that we were coming to a time when it would have been, the magnificence of what we had would have been diminished in time. And I think we both got off at the right time for both of us as individuals.
You know, you almost met by chance in Atlantic City when somebody got fired or didn't show up. And you and Dean Martin were working separately, and all of a sudden the axe meshed and you became Martin and Lewis.
Yeah.
Magical, wasn't it, when you look back on it?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was a great period. And the people, when we split, they were really very upset with both of us. How dare you disrupt this wonderful thing we had going? So we were very nervous about what would happen to us individually, but it worked fine. We were very, very blessed, both of us.
On the toll-free, Catherine, Rochester, New York. Hi.
Hey, how are you, Tab?
I'm fine, Catherine. Hope you are. Thanks for calling. Here's Jerry.
Oh, well, could I first say how much I enjoyed watching Tab from the Tomorrow Show?
Yes, you can. I appreciate that, Catherine. Thank you.
Anyway, my happy birthday to Jerry. And
thank you.
I very much interested in it. If there's a particular show that you and Dean did together that you liked.
I think I liked everything that Dean and I did. Particularly,
I enjoyed every one I saw.
Well.
I know I saw a lot of them.
We did some silly stuff. As a matter of fact, you can see most of the things we did together on the five shows that Disney's running. They run them they're scheduling them now almost every month.
On the Disney Channel?
Yes, on Disney Channel. And we made five shows of some of the highlights of the Golden Age of comedy, and I'm producing five more for Disney in the not-too-distant future.
When you look at those pictures of you and Dean, and this goes back now 40 years.
Sure. Oh,
40
yeah.
years. Do you ever look at the screen and say, geez, what happened to these two young guys? You know? When you think of it, Jerry, my goodness.
I'm sitting with my three-year-old daughter, who says, what's Daddy doing with that man? And the fun I'm having, when I was putting the five Golden Age of Comedy films together, she'd be with me. She's never apart from me, my miracle daughter. And she would love, and then she would ask me to impersonate what she saw on the screen. I was 18 or 19 years old at the time, and there's this 68-year-old jumping up and down in the living room like a damn baboon, and she's having the time of her life.
Yeah, and so are you, pal.
You bet. You bet.
Catherine, thanks for watching, hon.
I wanted to congratulate Jerry and his new show on Broadway, and I hope he really enjoys his run.
I'm having the best time of my life. Thank you very
Certainly
much.
Certainly sounds like it.
All yes. right. Hey, Catherine, you're up there in Rochester. Get on the Amtrak and come on down, kid.
Yeah.
I'd love to.
All right. See you soon, Catherine.
Give me the money first.
Catherine.
If you play your cards right, lady.
We don't give here.
There's a crew
here
that will chip in.
Good night, Catherine. Thanks.
Good night.
Bye-bye
Thank you.
Now. Back for a few more moments here with Jerry Lewis at 800-95-CBS-TV. I'm Tom, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Miss Alderman, here's my last lesson. Piano fighting.
Remember that night, Jerry?
Oh, my God. That's cruel, Tom. That's cruel.
Oh, celebrate it, my friend. It's our lives. Celebrate that.
Yes, I will.
It was so innocent then, you know. Television was so innocent, and the people on it were so innocent. It was simple entertainment then.
Yes. Well, I think that the technology today is such that it kind of puts you off a little bit. But if you really think about it, and you recognize that the miracle of this technology is bringing you into so many people's homes. It's really something to be awestruck by, really.
Except that in that day, a program would never have gone on the air. They had this program. I even hate to comment on this. I had a call from one of the magazines, and they said, Tom, would you comment on the Jenny Jones show where the guy got shot? I said, I don't want to get involved in that. But back in 1964, that wasn't what television was. It was pure and simple information and entertainment and not some of these wacko themes that we see discussed day in and day out in the afternoon.
Well, you're going to run out of what to do in a medium such as this. Now that we have 24 hours a day with 164 channels, they're going to have to put something on it. And unfortunately, some of the seedy material is going to get amongst some of the quality. You know that, and I know that.
Here is Elaine on the toll-free in Fort Smith, Arkansas. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, Elaine. Speak up just a bit.
Okay. Thanks. I have enjoyed your program.
Thank you.
For many years.
Thank you.
Mr. Lewis?
Yes, ma'am.
I can tell you, I have got to be your all-time number one fan. I don't think there's a movie you ever made that I haven't seen.
Well, thank you.
And by the way, happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
My husband's birthday is also the 15th of March.
The 16th?
Oh, I thought it was the 15th. Okay.
No, 16th.
Where Jerry is now, it's the 16th. Where
yes.
we are, it's still
right.
the 15th. Once
right.
again, Jerry Lewis is a day ahead of the rest of the country.
Isn't that something?
I hope you get a chance to come to New York and see Damn Yankees. You're in for a real treat if you come.
Well, I plan on coming in April.
Okay. We'll be there.
I was just wondering, are we ever going to get the chance to read about your life? Are you ever going to write a story of your life?
I'd like to live one first.
But you did a book some years back,
yes.
semi-autobiography.
Yeah, up to that point in
yeah.
my life, yes. But it's not complete. I don't know. I really don't know. I think that I'm so busy now having such a good time, I can't think that far ahead.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Elaine, thank you
I'll
for joining
I'll see you in New York, Elaine. Thank you.
I think in that book you talked about you had some regrets that you quit high school, but that you didn't finish up your education.
Yes, I had regrets early on, but I have had the greatest education in the world. I've been working very, very closely with people in my adult years that have given me a Brandeis University scholarship.
Right.
By the mere contact. I mean, I have friends like Dr. Michael DeBakey, Walter Anderson, Jonas Salk, people that teach me, I learn from, great, great people in this country that I am constantly in touch with, that inform me, and where would anyone get that chance to call on these people for information and a learning process that's beyond anyone's comprehension?
In reading about you this afternoon and in reading about you over the years, you've received many, many accolades. In fact, I believe at one time you were a nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Right.
But I read that you received an award in commemoration of Hubert Humphrey, the late senator from Minnesota, former vice president of the United States.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, did you ever get to spend any time with Hubert Humphrey? Did you know him?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
I spent some time with him in Washington, and he was a very, very meaningful player in getting some inroads made for the Muscular Dystrophy Association through some of his friends in Washington. He was a very, very important man who played a marvelous role in our growth process.
One of the reasons that I loved him so much, Jerry, is he always seemed to enjoy being Hubert Humphrey. Remember, he would make these long speeches
yes.
in the Senate, and he always had a smile. I mean, he just loved being in the Senate. He loved being vice president. He loved the whole thing.
Well, then you got to come and see the Hubert Humphrey of Damn Yankees. That's what I'm doing. I'm having the best time. I mean, I'm doing an impression of him on that stage every night.
Now, how long will you be in the show? What are you signed up for? Can you tell us?
I'm doing 6 months in New York. We stopped to do Telethon 95. Then I go on the national tour 2 weeks after the Telethon, and we do it for a year. We're negotiating for doing the film after we finish the national tour, which will take us to December of 96. I then will finish that by February of 97 and open it in London till February of 98.
Jeez.
And then we will take it to Paris. It's a terrible way to make a fortune,
yeah.
I can tell you that.
Jerry, it's good of you to stay up. I know you wanted to come on this show, but I know the weight was something you didn't figure on. So
it was okay, Tom.
Okay, my friend.
I appreciate you letting me plug the show, and it was a joy for me to see you on your new program, and I wish you a lot of mazel.
Hey, brother, can you spare a dime?
Anytime for you, Tom.
Talk to you, my friend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Good night, Jerry. Jerry night. Lewis, folks, from CBS in New York City. I should have asked Jerry what studio he was in there.
Yes.
Can we put him back up for a second?
Yes. He's back up now.
Rather studio.
Okay. Can they widen out? Is this a big studio or
no. Small studio. Well, it's a small studio that's just off the Big Dan Rather and Connie Chung studio.
Oh, the Big Dan Rather.
The Big Dan Rather and Connie Chung Whispering Studio.
Yeah. Could we widen out and just see how small it is?
There's no cameraman.
There's no cameraman, oh. No. You want to see what a good cameraman you got here?
Yeah.
How's it going, Tom? So these two Jews, actually...
Good night, Jerry. Thanks a million.
Good night, Tom.
Yeah, back there they're saying, you know, why does he do that? You know, I wonder how Jon Stewart would have handled that, you know? I'm going to be nice now, you know? But I mean, really. And he says to Stewart, he says, well, what's on at 12:30? And he says, not much. Jeez. Clive Barker is next up here. Moon Pictures. We'll be right back after these messages. We're not here following NC2A basketball and your local news on the hour. We have the Gulf War syndrome. Spouses of veterans say it's contagious. And then Carol Shia, the cop in New York who posed nude and got fired. As a writer, painter, director, and now executive producer of the horror film Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh, Clive Barker is well known as an artist with a vivid imagination, and we're happy to have him here with us on the color cast tonight. Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh.
Yes.
Central character, a young woman, right?
Yes.
Family cursed by the Candyman, and she's trying to find out why and what the curse means.
Right. The Candyman appeared in the first picture of that name.
Right. And for those who didn't see it, or are just coming on board, the Candyman
is a black man with a body full of bees and a hand which is turned into a hook or has been replaced by a hook.
Uh-huh.
And he's a pretty scary character, but he's also a kind of Phantom of the Opera sort of character in the sense that he's troubled and deserves at least as much pity as he does fear.
Okay. And maybe maybe the Candyman has some conscience of some sort.
Oh, for sure. And he has motives. He's not a sort of blind serial killer. He's somebody who has vengeful motives. He's actually the spirit of a slave who fell in love with a white woman and is and was parted from that woman and had his hand cut off and was fed to the bees and now comes back, if you say his name five times, into a mirror. He's an urban legend. We created an urban legend. As a kid, I was told all these stories. We were all told these stories.
Sure, sure.
I guess we were told them around campfires, and then we told them ourselves around campfires. And they were stories which happened to friends of ours. That was always the intro to them, because you always wanted to establish that there was some truth in them. And you said, well, I know a friend of a friend who... And some of them were comical. Some of them were things like people drying off their poodles in microwaves. An urban legend. But then there were also the scary stories. There were the stories of the hook-handed men who came after lovers in Lovers Lane and so on.
Sure. By the way, when we were kids at camp, we would sit around the fire, as you say, at night, and we would talk about kids we knew that saw a vampire.
Right.
You know, kids we...
The bogeyman stories.
Yeah, kids we knew who saw the wolfman at night under the full moon. And, you know, we'd go to bed under the covers kind of cowering at these people.
Well, part of the pleasure is that you do cower. I mean, there's certainly a pleasure in the fear, the frisson of fear.
Well, love to be frightened.
For sure.
Right. Now, let me ask you here in Farewell to the Flesh, Candyman. What is his motivation with this family? You know, I said there's a young woman who's trying to find out why the Candyman has got a curse on her family.
One of the things we try to do with all the Candyman pictures is have a plot, which isn't always...
This is a good idea in a picture.
Doesn't always happen in horror movies.
This is a good idea in a movie,
Horror movies are often plotless, but we've always tried to have a mystery element in here, and that's the heart of our mystery in Farewell to the Flesh. And in this Candyman picture, we have a connection between this anti-hero, this troubled monster, Candyman, and this woman, which I don't want to give too much away, because the story takes these characters through a kind of journey together.
I've got about 45 seconds worth of your picture here.
Okay.
Which will not give away anything. I believe this is a scene in which the woman confronts her mother
Right.
Trying to find out more about the Candyman.
Good.
So this is from Farewell to the Flesh, and you folks at home, you watch the monitors. Here it comes.
Child, your father was trying to destroy everything that we had by linking our name with that monster.
So you destroyed it instead by denying the truth.
I am not a part of him.
We're his family.
No.
We're his blood.
I will not have you talk like that in this house.
You can't wash him away with a bottle.
There is no Candyman. He does not exist.
Got it all going, don't
you? Oh, yeah.
You got the light.
The music's
flashing,
going, the lightning's
going.
Going.
He doesn't exist, this baby. Oh.
Exactly. And that's the problem, you know, you can't say monsters don't exist because that's when they come for you.
Now, some people would call this a horror story. Mm-hmm. You prefer to use the term imaginative fiction?
Yeah, could, I mean...
You use your imagination with this sort of thing.
You use your imagination. For me, horror films, it certainly has horrific elements in it, but it has a lot of damn fine acting and good storytelling, and it feels to me as though horror has become debased in the last few years. And when we talk about horror movies, increasingly we think of just mindless pieces of bloodletting, and we've tried to do something better than that.
In the UK, you grew up in Liverpool, is that
right? I
did,
sure.
And lived in London for a long time before coming here. Were our monsters big over there, like Bela Lugosi?
For sure.
Boris Karloff?
Well, you see, I have to be a little possessive myself here. Remember that those stories were based
upon... yours, of course.
Yes, right. I mean, Mary Shelley.
We took a lot from you when we came across the pond.
And that's right, absolutely. Yeah. And many of the actors who were in the Universal pictures of the 30s, which I'm very fond of, were English actors. I mean, Karloff, of course, was English.
Surely.
Ernest Thesinger was English.
Surely.
James Whale, who directed what I believe to be the greatest American horror movie, Bride of Frankenstein, was English.
Man.
Extraordinary picture.
You know, they used to show those when I lived in New York. They ran them on PBS back there at midnight. And I would sit there in the bed at night, you know, with the car.
Now, how old are you when you're cowering here?
Oh, God, I'm 45 years old. Are you kidding? Jeez. Are you kidding me? You know, you're alone in the house in New York City at night, and it's midnight. And, you know, they always... Did you have one where the moon comes up? They all had... Remember in Frankenstein?
Yeah, of course. And full moons, always.
Always.
Full
and
moons.
Dracula.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, you see, the interesting thing about Dracula is like Candyman, he elicits a certain amount of sympathy. For me, great monsters are not simply images of fear. They're also images that we feel a kind of ambiguity about. We're scared, but we also feel we get closer to them.
Dracula is doomed to live forever.
And fall in love with people he's going to lose. Karloff's Frankenstein.
Unless, of course, he gives them the gift.
Well, and then they're always sorry,
aren't they? Let me do a fast break here.
Okay.
We will continue with Clive Barker and your calls at 800-95-CBS-TV after these messages. We are back. Here's Mark in Naperville, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Hello?
Yes, we're here, Mark. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I wanted to know what Clive's opinion was on the tabloid shows comparing the Candyman story to the O.J. Simpson trial.
Thank you, Mark. well, I thought it was a nonsense. I did...
You see, not seeing those shows, I did not even realize that the comparison had been
made.
Well,
what happened was that a number of press commentators made the connection between the advertising for Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh, which has got the Candyman standing behind the heroine in a faintly menacing fashion, it has to be said.
Right.
I mean, no argument about that.
And as we saw here in the clip where Mama denies his existence. Sure.
For sure. And they said, they accused us, basically, of sort of riding the coattails of the O.J. Simpson tragedy
please.
You know. And my argument, the first thing what I said on Hard Copy was, you know, we made this movie a long time ago.
Long time ago.
We made the movie that this is a sequel to a long time ago. And there was no association whatsoever in our heads. We were troubled that somebody should have made that association. And as I said on Hard Copy, I felt it more reflected America's present preoccupation with
true,
the trial
true. So,
than it did about the advertising.
Right. Yeah. Let's say no more about it. Mark, thanks for the question.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks.
All right, bye-bye. Your role models?
Edgar Allan Poe, Ray Bradbury. I mean, people whose imaginative worlds completely changed my vision of the world when I was a kid. You know, Oz, Narnia, Never Never Land.
Hitchcock.
Of course. And then a lot of obscure movies, French movies, Italian movies, Japanese movies, the kind of stuff that I saw on late night television when I was a kid.
You know, when I was in school, we went, the lady I was dating at the time, we went over to the art theater, and they were showing a picture there called Diabolique.
Oh, great.
Oh, geez, what a picture.
Yes.
In fact, I've got it on I bought it at the store years ago. I haven't looked at it. Who's
the,
in that?
The bath. The bath scene.
Oh, when the guy comes out of the tub?
Absolutely.
I mean, you come out of the tub. Geez, oh, my God, it's unbelievable.
Well, one of the great things about these kind of movies are that if they're done well, they're very much audience participation movies. You know, you get involved. You can't sit in front of Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh, and remain unmoved. Even if you know, even if you don't like the movie, it's going to get hold of you. And the first time for me was Psycho. I was, I guess, 16 when I first saw Psycho. I couldn't believe
what
was being done to me.
What about Hitchcock? You always knew who did it.
For sure.
Yeah.
Well, they weren't really mysteries in that sense, were they?
No. They were, you knew who the killer was, but everybody on the screen didn't know who the killer
was.
And so you find yourself, geez, don't go in there.
Don't
go in there. This guy's going to nail you.
Sure. Except, I guess in Psycho, you didn't I certainly didn't realize the first time I saw it that Mother wasn't alive. I mean, when I first saw that movie, I assumed Mom was still alive, you know?
No. Mama gone.
Gone. Long gone.
Here is Daniel on the line in Atlanta, Georgia. Hello.
Hello, Tom.
Hi, Daniel. How you doing?
Hi, Daniel.
I'm doing fine. How are you doing, Clive?
Good, thank you.
Listen, my question is, I'm wondering, do you find it harder to write movies and screenplays for American audiences over writing your novels, which seem more cerebral horror
than
the blood and guts that we're used to?
I find, that's a good question. There's a complicated answer to that. I find writing novels very demanding because it's very solitary. You know, it's 18 months... me and some pieces of paper.
In a room with blank pieces of paper.
Exactly right. Without anybody ever looking at it, without anybody ever saying, well, that's good, that's bad, whatever. The making movies is very collaborative. The ideas you have are a kind of blueprint for other people's creation.
Why do you write in a room? Why wouldn't you pick some other venue? Like, I remember Alex Haley told me one time, he used to go on tramp ships, freighters.
Oh, really?
And he,
just lock himself away?
No. He would write at night.
Uh-huh.
And for inspiration, he'd go out and walk the decks in the South Atlantic.
Well, I need the organization of almost like an office. I need to be able to go and at 8:30 begin the writing process and write 3,000 words and stop. I need the rhythm of that. I need this kind of organization of that. Whereas movies, you know... it's a bunch of people. It's a bunch of ideas. It's a collaboration.
Sure.
And the fun for me of that is that people come up with better ideas constantly.
Sure.
You're dealing with a bunch of people who can be saying, you know what, we can improve that.
Yeah, what would happen if, and you try something
right.
else? Right.
Now, but taking up Daniel's point, there is also, and this is a problem for me, movie audiences are less intellectually demanding than readers.
I'm down to 30 seconds, as you should know.
It's all yours.
Okay. Daniel, thanks for joining, and thanks for the
Daniel.
Question.
Thank you very much.
Quickly, what scares you? What are you scared of?
Not a whole heap. My nightmares have been folded into my waking life in a way which I think is probably quite therapeutic.
I've enjoyed talking with you and meeting
you
tonight. I hope you'll come back soon.
I will indeed.
All right, thank you. Clive Barker, folks, the picture is called Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh. Opening nationwide on Friday.
On Friday.
Okay. Back to wrap it up after these messages.